You're listening to Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about outsourcing to agencies with Carl Crawley. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is sponsored by Hover, who seem to be adding even more awesome top-level domains. I just found out that .kitchen exists. But besides the crazy amount of top-level domains to choose from, Hover also has an uncluttered interface that makes the process of registering your domain so easy. If all of that sounds good to you, Hover is giving all our listeners 10% off their first purchase on hover.com when you use the promo code CONTROLCLICK.
CONTROLCLICK would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor. Hi, Leah. How are you?
Pretty good. I had a busy weekend doing, I guess, summer cleanup. Yeah. And the major part of that was cleaning up my grill.
So is that to get it ready for summer grilling, or had you been grilling all winter and it just needed a good cleaning?
Well, I didn't really clean or grill or do anything all winter. It was actually outdoors because Seattle weather is mild enough, I guess, for it to, like, I guess, withstand the weather. But I tried to grill without cleaning it, really, like, except, like, you know, the scrapey thingy at the beginning. And I almost had a grease fire.
Oh, my God.
It was so bad. Like, I like, you know, lit it up, and then it went boom, and I'm like, oh, I think.
I shouldn't be laughing. Thank God you're okay.
No, yeah. No, everything.
Still have your eyebrows?
Yeah. No, it was all good. And then that made me think, like, oh, I better clean this. And that took, I swear to God, I think it took maybe 2 hours straight. Well, because I think, it was just so much grease. And there's so many parts, you know? So, but now I'm looking forward to grilling.
Well, good. Now you have incentive to have some grilled food a lot.
Yeah, you know, when the weather is nice in Seattle, you want to take advantage of it.
Yeah, Jason's the grill master at our house. I might want to mention it to him. In fact, he's probably listening right now, so he should probably get cleaning the grill on his to-do list.
Beware of grease fires.
Yeah, I don't think we've cleaned it since we bought it, and we've had it for about a year and a half, so.
Yeah, it's time. It's time. All right, so just a quick bit of news for our listeners. A few episodes back, we mentioned that John McPherson was conducting a survey of expression engine rates. Well, he's finally compiled the results, which we'll link to in our show notes.
We also want to let our listeners know that the EE Help Chat, which we sponsor with Arcus Tech, is now on a monthly schedule. So you can join us the first Wednesday of every month at 4:30 p.m. Eastern. The permanent chat URL will be in our show notes.
And in more news, our major sponsor, Pixel and Tonic, has come out with a massive update with Craft 2.1 that includes 90 new features and improvements with a specific emphasis on workflow. It's such an excellent update that I can't wait to play with. And if you're new to Craft and you want a community-based resource for support, Craft is also trying to start a Stack Exchange site. So last I checked, it's already headed to private beta in what seems to be a record 5 days from the initial proposal. So that's exciting stuff for the community, and it really, I think it speaks to the passion around the software and the people behind it. So we'll have a link in the show notes to the initiative.
Awesome. Now to today's episode. Carl Crawley returns to the show, this time to talk about outsourcing to agencies. Carl is the managing director of Made by Hippo, a digital design and multimedia agency that outsources solutions to busy agencies and developers. Welcome, Carl. So nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to be back.
Perfect. So, Carl, for those that haven't heard you the first time around, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm based in the UK on a little island off the south coast of the UK. I've been here for about 12 years and live with my wife and 3 children and a dog. Yeah, like I said, been here since 99, originally moved from Wales via Scotland and settled here, really, and set Hippo up in 2010 after various other business ventures and kind of moved on, really.
I remember when we had you on, and I haven't looked at the calendar, but I think it's almost exactly a year since we had you on, and I think you were recovering from an injury. Are you still into martial arts?
I don't actively do martial arts anymore. I stopped doing that a while ago. I had too many commitments, and when my third my son was born, I just, you know, really couldn't put the time and effort into keeping it running. But yeah, that was actually during a silly phase I went through where I went on a bit of a health kick and joined a local soccer team. And decided actually that, yeah, my body isn't built for playing soccer at all.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So I don't do that again, and I haven't had any injuries since, so it's good.
That's a good way of staying uninjured.
Yes. You just don't exercise. Simple.
So you mentioned that you kind of went through a journey of different businesses and stuff. So why don't we talk about specifically Made by Hippo? Before we dive deep into the workings of that, I want to know more about the name of the company. Why is it called Made by Hippo?
So it was purely because I'd had many previous businesses over the years, and they were all, you know, something technologies, something systems, something HQ. Mm-hmm. And we had this running joke in the office at the time, one of my friends that is also in the industry. And I always said that the next business that I would launch would be either something totally abstract that couldn't be related to technology, or it would be something so technology focused that you, again, wouldn't have an idea what we do. So it was either Hippo, or it was going to be Webcom Dev Tech Systems. And I just, you know, we never really considered the latter. But the idea was, is that I got some really valuable advice when I first decided to start the business. And I wanted something that would stand out. Totally stand out. Mm-hmm. And because I don't do sales, I can do sales, but I choose not to. I needed just what I would consider to be a competitive edge. Because if I'm going to mm-hmm. be pitching for work, and I'm going to be pitching for products and projects, I needed something that would just give me a little bit of a competitive edge. And mm-hmm. if you have, you know, AN other technologies and AN other web solutions, and then a proposal from Made by Hippo, you would remember that one over the others just because it has a quirky name. Mm. And that was really why.
You know, Leia, I think it's not the exact process we went through with the rebranding we're going through now, renaming the company, but being able to stand out and, in fact, differentiate ourselves with a name was really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I never knew it because I named my company Emily Lewis Design. There's really not a whole lot creative there. But it wasn't until we began this process that I realized how important what you name your company is. Because like you said, Carl, I could do sales, but I would be miserable if I had to. And so having to stand out with a name when you're one proposal amongst a dozen.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
a really good point. Yeah, I can relate to that a lot.
And that was it. That was the reason why I did it. And it kind of caught on very quickly. And I think it was, the first person to ever reference it was in the early days of the EECI conferences where Robert Hearhart called me Mr. Hippo. And at that point, it just stuck. And yeah, this is it. Because that is now, you know, it's funny, it's an identity, and people mm-hmm. recognize it. And even now, you know, when I log into your regular help chat, you know, I log in as Mr. Hippo, and people always say,
know who you are.
Yeah, evening, Carl. Say, so, yeah, it's good. I have that kind of identity, which was the whole point of naming and branding the company like that.
So let's talk a little bit more about how you got started with Made by Hippo. So once you had the name, what were the first steps you did with the company?
One of the first things I really wanted to do was kind of try and give the company focus, because previous companies I'd had, you know, I'd had relative success with them, but they all had the same thing in common. And that was that once we became successful, you know, success is a relative word, but from a point of view of what we define success to be, once I got to that point within my previous businesses, I found that I was then no longer A, in control of anything, and B, doing what I enjoyed. You know, one of the last, I suppose, successful businesses I had, we grew the business to a healthy turnover. We had the great clients. It was brilliant work. But we had 8 staff, 3 directors, and all I was doing was project managing, chasing accounts, filing tax returns, doing salaries, and doing administration. Because actually that kind of stuff is not the kind of stuff that just can get left. So then I found that I was doing that an awful lot and I wasn't doing hands-on work. And I think I had a period where I was doing some project management work for a project and I left the office for about 2-3 weeks to go and do some project work. And when I came back, my fellow director and the head of my, what I consider to be my kind of my opposite, my number two in the technology, had made a decision to change technology platforms.
Oh.
And it was fine because actually when I understood the reasonings behind changing the technology platforms, they made commercial sense, they made financial sense and everything. However, I was then left in a redundant position because I wasn't capable in that technology. So I then had to adapt. And, you know, I love a challenge, and I did. I took that on. But that was really, really hard work, considering I owned the company, and I had to learn something just to be able to, you know, sustain my position in my own company. So when I started Hippo, I always said, you know, I would retain control. I wanted to retain the focus. And I would always, always delegate and outsource anything that I wasn't 100% comfortable with, happy with doing, or didn't want to do, basically.
Now, when with Made by Hippo, did you have a client roster that sort of rolled over to that from previous engagements, or did you have to start finding new clients straight from scratch?
It was starting from scratch. I was in a previous employment, which was a quite a high level management position for a company, and part of the terms of my employment were anti-freelance. So I wasn't able to carry out any freelance work. However, prior to my signing that employment contract, I had 2 or 3 clients that I had been servicing requirements for 7-8 years. And it wasn't huge amounts, but it was enough to just tick over. So they had to honor that. But the agreement was that at the point I signed the contract, I would not take any more client work on. So when I actually decided to leave and resign my position, it was a case of I finished on a Friday and I opened a laptop Monday morning as Hippo.
Oh, wow.
I was fortunate enough that I built up a bit of a reputation on Twitter anyway. And for the first, I would say for the first 9 months, I generated 100% of my revenue through Twitter leads. And that ranged from somebody in the community that wanted to try and do something that couldn't do it, so I would offer them some free advice and they still didn't get it, so it's like, well, okay, here's my rate card, I can do it for you if you like. And I would get a lot of that, and it wasn't just Expression Engine stuff. Actually, I think my second project was for somebody on the community, Joris Hendricks, on the community. He goes by the name Moon Beetle. He literally just gave me a couple of hours work doing some jQuery work. But it was born through the community and through the Twitter feed. And then, and it's something I still keep up now, and I'm quite all over Twitter really these days. But I understand the value of it, which is why. So I had to build it up from nothing, basically. And I was very, very aggressive with it.
So you just mentioned the type of work that maybe some... Oh, well, let me first step back and ask. In the beginning, did you consider Made by Hippo a freelance business?
Yeah, it depends what your definition of a freelance business is, because, yes, there was a time in Hippo in that it was only me. So you could say that it was a freelance business. However, from day one, Hippo has been incorporated and registered for tax and VAT. So it has been a corporate identity, not me trading as Hippo. So in that respect, it's a difficult one to answer, but yes and no, I suppose.
Well, I guess the reason I was asking is because when I started, I definitely thought of myself as a freelancer, and I really had a very narrow concept of what kind of client I could have or I could get. And the kind of work you just described that you got, just helping other developers out on Twitter, isn't something that I even considered. Not that I wouldn't have been capable or willing, but I was just like, oh, I've got to go find a client, which means it's a business that needs a website.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about a freelance, or even when you're thinking in a bigger sense of like a digital agency like Made by Hippo, what kind of clients can these types of entities have?
I always made the point at the very, very beginning that I didn't want to own my own clients. purely because that would mean I would then have to employ a project manager or an account manager to deal with it. I'd have to employ somebody who could handle billing and finance and all of those kind of things that get associated with it. So I've purposely set Hippo up as an outsource agency. So all of the clients that I were going for were design agencies, technology companies, marketing, sales companies, search engine marketing companies, you know, anything like that. Basically, any pre-existing agency, or it could be a freelancer, that has a requirement for my skills. And that was always my requirements. I turned work away at the very beginning, or actually I didn't turn work away. What I did very, very quickly was I formed partnerships. So I have a partnership with a design company who are just a design company. I have a partnership with an SEO company who just do SEO. I have a partnership with a hosting company who just do servers and hosting. And if somebody walks through my office's door or rings me up and says, you know, I'm Mrs. Jones from the local bakery and I want a website, great. Speak to my design partners. They'll design it for you. They'll deal with it all, and they'll give me working HTML or a Photoshop PSD file, and I'll then build it and make it work, because that's the arrangement I have with them. I won't take the client on myself, because then I have to deal with weeks of getting the client requirements, scope creep, spec creep, billing, arguing over pricing, and all that kind of stuff that I'm not being paid to do. So that's why I wanted to make sure that actually I can offload that by forming these partnerships with these companies and various kind of scales, from one-man band freelancers right up to, you know, whole development teams. And it just gives me, it allows me to focus 100% on the technology and on the implementation.
And I'm going to guess, based on what I'm hearing, is that it's also been more profitable?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Since the company's grown and it's now no longer just me, we're able to take on bigger projects and more work. I never turn work away. I've never, ever said no to a client. What I will do is I will resource a project based on its requirements. So it means that actually I can keep the company very lean. I have a core roster of people, but then I also have a vast database of freelancers and other agencies that I have a reciprocal partnership deal with, whereby if I need to outsource or I need to pull in additional resource on a project, I can.
Now, are these like business deals, or they're just, you know, handshakes, good reputation, you get along with them, with these agencies? Or is there some sort of contract where, let's say, a woman comes into a bakery down the street, wants a website, you send them to the design firm? Is there anything that legally prevents them from sending the work to someone else if they don't give it to you when they've done their part?
Some of it depends on the client. Some clients I have contracts with that stipulates that they will give me the work, or if I don't want the work, or I choose not to take the work on, or they choose to give it elsewhere, that I then get a fixed fee, finder's fee for the project. Some of my clients, and actually I would say that the former clients with contracts are very, very minimum. I would only say I've got about two or three of them. All of the others are done, rightly or wrongly, but, you know, through a shake of hands, a gentleman's agreement, that is what we will do. I don't just work for anyone. You know, I all of my clients I know on a personal level through, you know, many years of communicating on Twitter or in the EE forums or various conferences, or I know them personally for some of the agencies that are local or agencies in the UK. You know, I travel up and I spend some time at their offices so they get to see the kind of thing that I can do for them. So it does vary, and it also varies on what kind of relationship I have, because there are lots of different relationships that I do for the agencies, and each of those have kind of a different set of rules, if you like.
So it looks like there's, you know, a variety of people that you work with, and pounding the pavement, Twitter, conferences in person, that's how you find them. Did you have a specific agency or person in mind? Like, when you go to these conferences or hang out on Twitter, do you think to yourself, I really need to find a good designer? And then as you're speaking to people, do you source them through that? Like, what is your process really trying to find out who you want to work with slash for?
So I generally spend a lot of time on Twitter, like I said, you know, looking at the hashtags and my own feed. Sometimes, you know, I get a requirement there, or I have an idea for something for a client's project that I don't have a resource for. And I'll then just put a shout out on Twitter. I would say I'm fairly strict with who I follow on Twitter. I mean, there are some, you know, I have, you know, friends that I follow that are just friends, but a lot of the time, the people that follow me and those that I follow on Twitter are a good kind of network and a good resource mm-hmm. to tap into. So I think it was last week or the week before, I have an iOS guy who does mobile app development, but I had a potential requirement for some augmented reality work within a mobile app. But he doesn't do augmented reality. He held his hand up, couldn't do it. So I put a shout out, and I got the names and numbers of two or three people that had been recommended to me, and I was able to kind of get in touch with them and get some idea of costs and project scope. So I do use that quite a lot. I would say I receive outsourced work more than I outsource.
Interesting.
So I have a lot of agencies, and actually I do work on recurring revenue models with the agencies. So the idea is that they don't sign me up just to build them a website for one of their clients. What they do is they are tapping into my company as a resource of time. So they can say, well, yeah, we have this project, but actually we also have this project coming up next month. Can we book some time ahead for you? And actually, I even have non-hands-on roles. I have two agencies who I do work with on a regular basis, but actually they have an in-house development team, but both companies are literally just one-man development teams, and they pay me they pay the company just to give them not hands-on, but eyes-on. So they build a website, and they then give us the CP access and FTP access. We go in, we look at the code and the logic and where they've used embeds and snippets, and we then send them a little mini report back saying, yep, it's good to go, that's fine, or you should consider refactoring these embeds, or, you know, you're using this template code wrong, and etc. Mm-hmm. And we just simply advise them. We don't actually do any of the hands-on stuff.
So are those like retainers with Made by Hippo?
Yes. Yeah, most of our clients are on retainers. I'd say 99% of our clients are on retainers.
Oh, wow. So let's take a little bit of a step back. When you have that shout out to CEO, I need somebody for this, and then you get the names and stuff, what criteria or characteristics do you look for in that person or that agency? Like, how do you know, right, this is the person that's good for this?
Right, that you can trust them.
Yes.
So the first thing I would do is, a lot of it goes on the source of the recommendation. Mm. So the person that's recommending that agency or that freelancer to me, if I value their opinion and I think they themselves don't suffer fools gladly, then I'm going to trust their opinion a bit more if they, you know, give me a recommendation, and then I'll follow that up with them at a later stage. But to be honest with you, a lot of it is some faith. You have to have some faith in it. And a lot of the time, actually, what I prefer doing, because written communication can be misinterpreted so much.
Sure.
I'm very much a people person, speaking to them. So if they have a requirement, even when we get, you know, we get regular inquiries through our website for requirements, and I'll get sent very basic, you know, hazy specifications. And the first thing is like, great, that's a good start. So let's pick up the phone and have a chat. Because actually then I get a feel for, is this client serious? Or are they just sending out specification to, you know, 15 agencies? And also then they get a feeling of confidence and a bit more in me to be able to then take it to the next level.
Now, in terms of the work that you do provide, that you outsource, you mentioned you provide consulting kind of eyes on for two agencies, kind of doing an audit after their work or some QA. What other kind of services do you outsource?
Yes, we have the eyes on service we do. We have maintenance and support packages that agencies come to us for a lot of the time. That is, I would say, since October, November last year, that's been one of our biggest packages whereby an agency, you know, like yourselves or any agency of any size really, have a monthly fee And within that monthly fee, we maintain Expression Engine, we upgrade Expression Engine, we upgrade all the add-ons, we maintain it, we keep it working, and barring any fundamental problems with upgrading from version to version, we will then also go in hands-on and fix any logic or conditional errors with new versions. And we have a lot of companies that do that, because actually a lot of the agencies that we deal with are, because they're 1, 2, 3 people in the company, for them it's more of a conveyor belt of work. So they build the work, they launch it, they then want the next project, because actually once they've built it, they're not generating enough revenue to then just sit on that client. And so what we do is we take that client on, we optionally host it, but if we don't host it, then you can host it and we get all the details. And then, yeah, we log in and we use various reporting tools and monitoring systems just to basically keep EE maintained, keep all the add-ons maintained, and keep the whole site running, so that then in 6, 9, 12 months later, when the original client comes back to you as an agency and says, right, we now need to add this subscription system to the site, as an example, you don't get to a point where you think, oh no, it's running EE 2.4, we've got to spend a couple of days upgrading it, and all these add-ons are out of date. You know that actually it's going to be running 2.8, and it's going to be up to date, and all the add-ons are going to be up to date, and you can then just move into the project, and you get the peace of mind.
So what you're describing to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the agency builds the site for their client, and then when the site's done, they hand that client to you. You guys do maintenance work, and then if that client wants new development, they can go to the original agency. That doesn't go to you, because you've been working with them regularly on a maintenance perspective?
No, that's fundamentally it, yes. But we have two ways of dealing with it, is that we work transparently. So we will be, I could just be, you know, the maintenance guy from Emily Lewis Design. And I have an email address at your domain name, and I respond to the client on your behalf, and we maintain the site. And then the client may come back to me and say, oh, we want you to add this new bit to the website. I will then come back to you and I'll say, the client wants this new bit on the website. I can do it for you. It will cost you this much, or you can do it yourself, but here's the heads up. And then we have other clients whereby they don't want to get involved in any of the maintenance, any of the support, any of the management. And when they launch the website, they then say, right, now speak to Carl at Made by Hippo, and he will maintain and he will run everything for you from this point forward.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah. And it's fascinating, because when you operate your own business a certain way, sometimes you forget that there's like a dozen other things you could do to allow yourself to focus in new areas or reach certain clients. Something like that never even occurred to me, but it's brilliant, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's worked for us. I mean, it was originally a very small subset of what we do. I mean, our main work was really kind of, you know, add-on development and customization and site builds. And I don't do design. Like I said, I outsource my design. I have 3 or 4 design companies that I use, or freelancers that I use. And I outsource all of that. But we get a lot of requirements where designers will come to us. And it was about 12 months ago, I think it was, we just started getting all of the agencies, look, you know, we'll just give you Photoshop files. You build them. You build them, we'll give you Photoshop files. I don't know one end of HTML and CSS from another. through choice, and responsive design still to this day eludes me. So I needed to change my view on that. So I got a resource, and I got somebody who now works for me who does front end. It just so happens he also does Expression Engine. So he can not only do the responsive CSS and HTML, but he then wires up the templates into the basic channel structures, etc. And then I get involved if it needs any custom development programming or add-ons or anything like that. So it is a good mix, but we do cover every aspect of outsourcing. It's not just, I want you to build me a website. It could be, we have a website, but we want you to build a shipping add-on for us. Or we have a website in EE1. Can you upgrade it to EE2? The answer will be no, by the way. but, you know, so we do get a lot of them. And like I said, you know, the eyes-on stuff is pretty good as well, because you get to see how other people implement stuff.
Right.
And that's really quite good, just to kind of get an idea and think, ah, I didn't realize you could do it like that. Even I get those kind of moments every so often, because mm-hmm. you get stuck into the same way of doing something. Mm-hmm. And then when you see somebody else doing it slightly differently, it does make you think about it. And that is the beauty of it.
I want to talk a little bit more about some of the relationships that you are building, especially when it can vary depending on the particular client or the project. You mentioned how some of them just fully give it to you after launch, and then other times you have to ask, oh, they requested this from me. Do you want to do it? Or, you know, I could do it and then I'll charge you. That leads to, what kind of boundaries are there? What boundaries do you set for yourself when outsourcing yourself?
I'm very honest and transparent and very ethical in my dealings. And right at the very beginning, it can be something as simple as a simple email to the client. And it just is, you own the client, or I own the client. Mm-hmm. And that defines the boundaries. So if you own the client, I don't do anything unless you tell me to. Mm. If I own the client, I make that choice. I make that judgment call. And I will never take a project away from one of my clients or one of the agencies I work with, because you're kind of biting off the hands that feed you then. Mm-hmm. Because that agency is not just one agency, you know, one project. It's 15 projects a year, maybe even more. So it's not in my interest to take a client off the agency unless the agency want to give it to me. If the agency have said, you know, and I've got a few of them now, they don't have the time to deal with the agency because they're moving on to other projects, or the client is particularly demanding. However, I've been working on the site on a maintenance and support package for 10 months previously, so I know the system intimately anyway. They may then just turn around and say, right, you take the client on, you deal with it, and we'll go from there. And I do. Some clients ask for a retainer or a finder's fee. Some don't. Some just want their client to be, you know, serviced and to be happy. And varies on the project, it varies on the client. But I'm very ethical in that, and I'm very kind of open and transparent with all of my dealings.
Regarding that transparency, I feel like where there could be a possible sticking point, and I feel like this is all over the agency world, what about rules in regarding promoting what you've worked on?
So if you ever have a look at my company's website portfolio, you'll see that the first thing that I say is in association with, or in partnership with, or something along those lines. Unless it's specifically requested, I mm-hmm. always put it in my portfolio that it was done in a partnership capacity or in some kind of association. If the client specifically asks for it not to be in the portfolio, in my portfolio, then I don't. I'm fairly happy to do that. At the end of the day, they're paying me to do the job, so all I'm concerned with is do the job, because the sacrifice that I have by not putting it in my portfolio, I would hope would be redeemed by lots more work from them. But most clients are not, or most agencies I've dealt with have not really had many issues with it. Obviously, I would never pass off somebody else's work as my own. If I've ever worked in partnership with company, whether it's a designer or it's an agency, I've always, wherever possible, mentioned that agency in the write-up or in the content.
When it comes to that sort of stuff, is particularly, I've received like a subcontractor agreement where I outsourced to a larger agency, and that, before we even started the work, that sort of defined the whether or not I could include the work on my own portfolio. So is that the situation where you actually have like a subcontractor agreement or some type of contract that specifies it? Or is that too kind of a gentleman's agreement?
Yeah, I mean, I have it in the contracts. So in my contract of service, I do have a clause in there that says that the agency or client have allow me to put it in my portfolio. That's in there by standard. If they particularly take an issue with it and want that removed, then again, pick up the phone, we chat about
right.
it. You know, why do you not want me to promote the fact that I've done this work? It could mm-hmm. be they're not telling the end client that mm-hmm. I'm an outsource agency, which is absolutely fine. So on that basis, we work on the, as I said earlier, on the invisible contract. So it's a, you know, I will be Carl at whatever your domain name.com is. And I have about 17 of them in my email client. And I am just head of technology, development manager, you know, whatever you want. I just pick a fictitious title and I represent your company.
So you provide the contract documentation, or does the client also provide their own subcontractor agreement? Because in my own experience, when I've outsourced, I've had to sign their agreements, and I didn't have my own agreement for that relationship. I just did what their document said.
Normally both. So normally there would be both. I always submit my standard terms and a standard contract of things that you can expect from me and how I work. A lot of clients send me their own requirements or their own terms, particularly, you know, the work for hire stuff where you have, you know, I sign away all rights to the intellectual property and so on and so forth. But, you know, yeah, it really depends and varies on a per client basis. Most of the small to medium agencies make do with the contract that I supply because they're getting into a relationship with the company. It's not a contract for a specific project. So we have a mutual non-disclosure agreement. We have the standard contract terms of service. And then we will deal with on per project basis, because it may be I have a client that, you know, I may do a project which you're happy for me to put in my portfolio that I worked with you on. But the next project you get in, you may not want that. So it can't be a blanket policy. Mm-hmm. It needs to be on a per project basis. However, the relationship is just company to company, not for a specific project.
Well, I feel like a lot of this is, you know, judgment calls, even with all the legalities and things like that. I'm curious how you would handle conflict of interest, especially because you're working on the agency's project and they may have somebody that has overlapping skill set. First of all, what would be considered conflict of interest to you, and then how would you handle that?
It's never been raised before, actually, funnily enough. I suppose I have had a situation in the past whereby one of the agencies that I've got a contract with have received a tender for a contract that I also personally received a tender for. And I only found out that that agency in particular had received the tender because obviously they sent me the tender and asked me to provide technology input for their proposal. And in that situation, I just, again, it's about just being honest and transparent. I told them that I'd received the tender as well. And we agreed that we would submit two proposals, one which would be made by Hippo branded and one which would be branded in their company name. The costs were virtually identical. And we both had a mutual understanding that if either one of us won the work, we would deal with our own respective skills. So if I won it, I would outsource the design to them. If they won it, they would outsource the technology to me. I've had one client who asked if I would sign away the rights to building another website like his business. It was a... It still is a client site that I run. Whilst I didn't agree to it, I have said that I would not take on another business in the same sector without speaking to him. And again, we have a really good relationship, and he trusts that would, you know, I would hold my end of the bargain up if that would ever happen. I deal with it on a case-by-case basis, really. I can't honestly say I have a blanket policy on what I would do in those situations.
Is that the best advice, perhaps, you would offer to someone who wants to move forward with outsourcing their work to agencies, is to be flexible and respond based on the relationship you have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the single most useful bit of advice you could give anybody looking at outsource, is be flexible. You have to be flexible in lots of different ways. Flexible on costs, because whilst you have a day rate or an hourly rate, the agency are working to different constraints. So you have to be flexible to that extent. You have to be flexible as well on the end result or the requirements and how you do it. I'm not a very good micromanager. Actually, I'm not a micromanager. When I outsource to people and when people outsource their requirements to me, I expect some level of autonomy to be able to fulfill the requirement in the most optimum solution that I'm capable. What I don't want is somebody saying, I want you to do this, and this is how I want you to do it. Because actually, that's, you may as well go and get, you know, somebody out of high school that knows how to use a computer, and you can sit on their shoulder and you can point up which keys you want them to press. You know, what people are getting from me is the end result. So this is the problem. This is the requirement. Give me my solution. They don't want to know what's in the middle, because that's what they pay me for. I always use an analogy of an architect or building a house. You don't employ a builder to build the house and then stand there and tell him which bricks to use and which cement to use and, you know, which wood to use and how to pave the front. You rely on his ability and his skills to do that. You just say, build me a house, and these are the requirements for that house.
It's also a good analogy, house building, for this outsourcing, because it's very rare that a contractor does drywall and plumbing and electrical and all that other stuff. And so it's really a matter of building relationships with people who have those specialties, and then they do the work together as a unit, but they're all sort of independently providing their services.
Absolutely, absolutely. I had a great chat with Brad Pascal. He'd done a talk at the time about building websites and outsourcing, because he actually has, or his talk was about the opposite. The fact he outsources nothing. What he does, he either buys companies or he employs people. So he has designers, he has SEO guys, he owns a hosting company, he owns a content company, he has it all. And for that, it means that it's all in-house and he has complete control of it. What I do is slightly differently. I still offer it all. However, I do it through partnerships and agreements with other companies. So, like I said, I have two SEO companies. One is very much a high-level SEO, and they do some amazing work. But, you know, it's on, you know, high-level, multilingual, e-commerce, you know, amazing stuff. And then I have a freelancer who is a phenomenal SEO guy who does the middle to the low end stuff. Mm-hmm. But I still provide the service. So my agencies, my clients come to us and say, we have this website. We want you to do X, Y, and Z. We want you to manage an ad campaign. We want you to give us some requirements, or, you know, et cetera. What I then do is I then speak to my guy, whether it's the high end SEO or the freelancer. He comes back to me and says, right, we need to make these changes in the HTML. We need to add this metadata. We need to put these tags in for Google Analytics. And that then gets funneled through to my front-end guy, who then does it and maintains it. You know, so we still retain it. We still have the client. But rather than having a salary bill of 50, 60 staff across 5 or 6 different companies, it's still only me and the core team.
I still feel like, though, that you would be doing a lot of project management, especially if it's under your brand, Hippo brand, but you're outsourcing, you know, front-end here and design here, but the client is facing you.
Well, the client never faces me. So the agency would face me. I generally don't get design stuff, I have to say.
Okay.
Because most of my clients are designers or design agencies. Most of the work that we get is technology-based or back-end-based. So, yes, I suppose you could say there is an element of project management, because we still have to kind of coordinate all of the moving pieces.
Yeah.
But it's within a very small subset of the whole project. So we just get a requirement, which would be to manage or to deal with an ad campaign. We have a site at the moment. It's a multilingual site, 8-9 different languages. And all we do is we maintain it. We just maintain the EE add-ons and the code base. And they've signed an ad agency to do a series of ads on their website, and they sell advertising. So the ad agency just send us all of the JavaScript and the HTML we need and what pages we need to do it on based on what ads they've sold. That gets funneled through at the front end guys, and, you know, we add it to the templates and whatever snippets are required, and hook that up to the click tracking in Google Analytics, and that's it. We deliver it back to them, and that's our involvement.
And I would imagine that where the project management does exist, if you're working with the same people for the same type of work, whether it's for different projects, but that your communication is down. It's not, you know, I think one of my greatest challenges with project management is when the client's involved in it.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm directly dealing with the client who doesn't understand the technology, and there's just a lot of more hand-holding and that sort of thing, versus me and Leia talking about what needs to be done between the two of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that because I'm pretty, you know, 99% of the time dealing with other web professionals. There is not so much project management to be done. There's not so much hand-holding to be done. Because whilst the other web professional may not understand what it is they're going to get in the technical aspect, they understand enough to say, right, this is what we want you to build. Now go away and build it. Whereas the end client is, because ultimately it's their money they're spending, they're going to want to know a lot more details. They're going to know why you've done something a certain way, how you're doing it, and all the intricacies. And that's where the handhold and the project management takes time. And where we're dealing with other professionals, it's just, right, the client wants this. You've spent the last kind of few hours, few days, weeks, convincing them that that's the best way forward, and there's the reasons for that. What I'm getting then is just a definite task.
So it feels like we've been talking a lot about advice you can give to someone working with an agency. I want to flip that discussion and ask you what you think the best advice you can give to an agency that's working with an outside contractor or company.
So I would say that you need to have trust and confidence in what they do. I've spoken to lots and lots of agencies who outsource to the Middle East or the Far East to various software development houses. And yes, you know, we all know that they're really cheap, really, really cost effective. However, time and time again, I've spoken to agencies who've just said, you know, yes, it is cheap, but you don't know how much hand holding you need to do. And actually, they are even more robotic in their approach. You give them a requirement, they will do exactly that requirement. Whereas dealing with somebody like myself or some of the other agencies that do outsourcing, you're going to get pushback. And that's what you should expect. If you're not getting pushback as an agency for requirements, you're not dealing with the right outsource company. Because what you don't want is somebody that is just going to do everything you say. What you want is you want to be challenged. And if you have a requirement and somebody says, I want you to do this, you want a, have you thought about doing it this way instead, which could mean that you can upsell, we can add more functionality, we can give the client more value. Because it's in my interest to upsell. So if I push back and say, you know, you need to think about this, maybe we do it this way. If you come back and say, you know, I totally understand what you mean, but this is really what the client wants, fine, I go and do it. But you want that pushback. You need that pushback. So you need to have that confidence and autonomy. Like I said, you need to give the agency requirement, the outsourcer requirements. If they're not able to then just fulfill those requirements without being micromanaged, again, you're using the wrong outsource agency.
Wow. So much food for thought here.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was amazing, but we got to wrap this up a little bit.
Yes.
But before we do have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
Oh, right.
It's painless.
Okay.
It's all good. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. First question. macOS or Windows?
macOS.
What is your favorite mobile app?
Oh, Facebook.
What is your least favorite thing about social media?
People believing everything they read and see.
What profession other than yours would you like to attempt?
Oh, dear God. I'd like to own and run a hotel.
Oh, wow. What profession would you not like to do?
Be a web developer.
Who is the web professional you admire the most?
Low.
What music do you like to code to?
Depends what I'm doing. Web programming, EE work, it'll be anything poppy, jumpy, upbeat. Any database development, heavy metal.
What's your secret talent?
I can bench press a lot of my friends.
What's the most recent book you've read?
Dan Brown's latest book.
And lastly, I'm still laughing. lastly, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Oh, I'd have to say Star Wars.
All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us, Carl.
No worries. Thank you very much.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, at CW Crawley, or at Made by Hippo, or my website, madebyhippo.com, or you can just email me hello at madebyhippo.com.
Great. Thanks, Carl. It's always great talking with you.
No worries. Thank you very much.
We'd now like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Hover and Pixel & Tonic.
We also want to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, Devotee, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at ControlClickCast or visit our website, ControlClickCast.com.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when Stephanie Sullivan-Ruiz is joining the show to talk about her experiences evaluating and choosing a CMS. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara.
And Emily Lewis.
Signing off for Control Click Cast. See you next time.
Cheers.